Welcome to the Scottish Watches podcast. Many years ago, we wanted to get a guest on the show, an elusive guest, someone that you've never really seen before, but hides behind the curtains a bit like the Wizard of Oz, and it's taken over 2 years to get to this momentous occasion. But today, we have the man with the hands from Watchfinder. Yes, those videos, the ones you check out, the ones that have got the great storyline and the soothing voice, we have got the man behind the veil, Andrew, with us today. But we've also got Dave, so we need to sort of say hello to Dave. How is Dave doing?
I'm good. How are you, Ricky?
I am fine. Thank you for asking. Yeah, we've dealt with the pleasantries. Dave's out of the way, and it's time to talk to Andrew. So how are you doing, Andrew?
Yeah, I'm very well, thank you. Thank you very much for having me on.
Yes, it's been a long time coming. This has been harder to arrange than getting Jean-Claude Biver on the show.
Yeah. I can only say as to what that means to my stature.
We always start the show in the same kind of vein, and it is with a wrist check. Now, what have you decided to liberate from the vaults at Watchfinder today?
Well, I'm wearing the one and only watch that I own, which is my Grand Seiko SBGV 245. And it's a watch that I bought on a whim a few years ago, having sold an Oris 65 Divers that I had. And I thought, that looks rather nice. I hadn't seen it before. It'd only just come out with Grand Seiko. I think it was a Japanese import at the time, and it was being sold pre-owned. And I thought, that looks really nice. I hope it looks nice in real life. And it did. And it's actually one of the nicest watches I've ever owned, which is unbelievable considering it was a sub £1,000 quartz watch. But it really is. I don't know if you've seen it on the channel. It's appeared a few times, but it's one of the watches that we've been able to put a lens in really, really, really close, and it just doesn't falter. It's absolutely immaculate.
I actually have that piece as well. It's a fantastic piece, that watch.
It is. It's a very sporty watch. It's on a greenish canvas strap. It's got very stubby angular lugs and then very big markers. But the main thing that I really like about it is it's got this brushed steel grey dial, which makes the whole watch feel like it's one piece of metal, which makes it feel very substantial. And just the way it reflects as well, it goes from a very deep champagne colour to a really bright silver. And as you know, Grand Seiko dials are just always the showpiece of the watch. But quite often, some of the Grand Seiko cases can get a little bit fussy. But this one is just absolutely fantastic, which means, of course, they've discontinued it. Can't have too much of a good thing.
True. Don't worry, there'll be another 14 iterations of it coming out relating to some kind of leave that fell outside Grand Seiko's headquarters in autumn last year.
Yeah. A bug that one of them stepped on or something.
Yeah.
The particular shape that they made in a dog turd with the boot of their shoe.
So, exactly, yeah.
Right, Dave, your turn. What's on the wrist?
Today, I've still got my Moser on, my Streamliner. So, yeah, loving that still. Can't quite get round to getting it off my wrist. I know it's Speedy Tuesday and all that, but, you know, I just couldn't be bothered changing it. So I have stuck with that, which, again, for me is a piece that just really is getting harder and harder to not be the absolute go-to every day. But I suppose that's what happens sometimes when you hit the magic nail on the head and you find exactly what you've been looking for. So, yeah, it's an absolutely fantastic piece.
I'm going to tell people to check the show notes as they are listening.
Okay.
We have got our prize quarterback, Miziel. He's been busy creating the best show notes I've seen of any podcast, and I'm not just saying that because it's our podcast. The guy puts in so much effort every week. It takes him 3 or 4 hours, probably almost as long as it takes to edit the shows. Him going away, and every time we mention a watch, he goes and finds a link to it, he finds the photographs for it, he types it up, puts it in the show notes. So as we're speaking, if you want to see what Dave's watch looks like, if you want to see Andrew's watch, check the show notes as you're listening. It will not interfere with the playback, and you can play along at home. So it's time to speak to the star of the show. So for people that don't know your backstory, and it is kind of difficult to pin you down, we actually have a group chat on Teams where all our writers and contributors are on, and I set them the task over a year ago to go and hunt you down, and it took them a little bit of time to go and find you. So well done on that. You evaded capture for quite some time. But for the folks that don't know, do you want to give us a bit of background on yourself and how you came to end up at Watchfinder, how you got into watches, and how you've got the dream job that everybody that's on YouTube wants?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, funnily enough, I started in absolutely nothing to do with watches. Straight out of school, I went into civil engineering. Something I loved very much because of the problem solving, the mechanical side of it. There's a lot of things to get your brain into. And I enjoyed that for a very long time, up until the point where I started to become more senior. And that involved talking to more people at local government and getting involved with red tape and boring, boring, boring. On the side, I was getting very interested in something a bit more creative, bit of photography, bit of writing. It's something that I've had a passion for from a very young age. And I really enjoy writing narrative and fiction and things like that. But what was becoming apparent to me is that I couldn't do the engineering anymore. It wasn't something that I could dedicate my life to. But this creative stuff, this was really interesting. Now, I also liked watches. This was something my dad handed down to me, literally, as a Seiko. He gifted me a Seiko, I think, for my 16th birthday. And at that point, yeah, he likes watches. He always wanted a Breitling. I knew about watches. I liked watches, but I didn't know about watches. I didn't know the backstory, the technicality. It was just, I would walk past a jeweler's window and I would see a Seiko and think, oh, that one looks nice. I like that one. And that was about it. When I graduated as an engineer, I rewarded myself with something that a lot of people in that kind of industry do. I rewarded myself with a Rolex. And this was before you all think I'm paid too much. This was back in the day where you could buy a non-date Submariner for a few thousand pounds. And yeah, That's exactly what I did. And it was, you know, I bought it pre-owned. I wore it for a long time. It was great. Really, really loved it. And the more I owned about it, the more I looked into it, because I'm a bit like that. I either do a lot of research into a purchase, or I buy something and then retrospectively try and find out to make sure I haven't made a terrible mistake by doing yep. the research afterwards.
Yep.
But the Agreed. More I read into it, the more I found out that Rolex isn't just a watchmaker that exists. There was a history to it. There was a heritage to it. There was a change over time and fashion and technology that had made this thing evolve from a tool watch, as unpalatable as it is to use that expression, into a luxury item. Now, the one I had, and this is where my interest was peaked, was the 14060M. Now, I only remember that because I Googled it so many times. I'm terrible with reference numbers usually. And the big deal with the M, this was my first taste of the watch community as a whole. The big deal with the M was that it had an extra line of text on the dial. And I could not understand how an entire community could be so enraged by this thing. But it led me to do more research into it. It led me to uncover more about watches and other brands. And hey, who's this JLC? What have they done? Mm-hmm. And this was all sort of bubbling away as I was getting more and more frustrated working as an engineer, up until the point I saw an ad in the local paper, for want of a better word, but local ads, Watchfinder, the pre-owned watch right. specialist, you know? Mm-hmm. And they were looking for someone to write watch descriptions. You know, plain and simple, not a very high paid job. I was earning fairly well as an engineer, as you can imagine.
Yeah.
But I thought, this seems like an opportunity to do something that covers more bases of things that I find interesting. So I applied for the job. I sent a few descriptions that I put together on my watch and a few other watches that I liked, sent them over, and I had an interview. And the interview did not go as I expected. Because what started as just talking about watch descriptions, what do you know about watches? Why do you like watches? If you like watches, do you think writing watch descriptions all day, every day will make you not like watches anymore? It started to turn into talking about, okay, so you know you do like watches and you like being creative. And what do you think you could do with Watchfinder and for Watchfinder?
Mm. All right. And
this was a period when the company was a shop, and actually what the company was looking to do was to become a brand.
Okay, yeah. Well, I'll stop you there because I've got a few questions that the listeners might want to know as well. What year was this that you bought your sub?
Oh, man. Now, you're testing my memory here, and my memory is absolutely awful. Dates, numbers, anything. 10, 11 years ago?
Right, okay. And what was Watchfinder like? Because we think of Watchfinder as we know it today, this massive powerhouse that controls almost the whole of the UK. No one else has got a look in, and obviously was bought by Richemont Group because it was doing so well a number of years ago, and you guys make, without doubt, the best videos on the internet when it comes okay. to watches. So what was it like back in the day then, you know, 10, 11 years ago?
It was 20, 30 people in one small building. Everyone juggling a lot of balls, all doing the best we could to really provide what we thought was going to be the best experience.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what really enticed me to the role, was because I was being given an opportunity to be on the other side of everything that I had been involved with researching into my own watches. I could offer that information. I could show watches in a way that people hadn't seen before.
Yeah.
And it started off with a blog writing for that, getting feedback from people, seeing what people were interested in, seeing what they weren't interested in, delving into the community, finding out more about who are the people who buy watches and what they want to hear about. And this evolved over time, and we got into video production maybe, I want to say, 5 years in, so probably 5 years ago now. Mm-hmm. And the first video that we did was, we've never done videos before. We thought, oh, we can take pictures with DSLRs. I wonder if what happens if we press the video button and point it at things. And so we took that around the service center. We were asked to showcase our brand new shiny service center that a lot of money had been spent on, to showcase what everyone was up to in there. And it was a really, really important thing for the brand, because it was, well, one, it was a lot of money, but the expertise behind it was often unseen.
Yes.
So we took the camera in, we pointed it at our head watchmaker. He took apart a Rolex Submariner. We showed it in close up. We uploaded it, and we didn't think much more of it. A few views trickled in here and there, until about a year later, we went on for Christmas holidays, came back, and the video had 1 million views.
Cool.
And we thought, hold on, what happened here? And we traced it back. It had been on GQ and Esquire online. And we sort of delved back through the data. Where had it been before that? Some content aggregating sites. And where had it been before that? Someone had posted it on Reddit, on the video subreddit. Look at this thing. You know, some visual ASMR of this very intricate piece being taken apart. And we thought, hang on a minute. People have less and less time to engage with reading. That's what we were fulfilling at the time.
Yep.
Where people are really moving to is listening, audiobooks, podcasts, and visual video. Can we do something with that? We had a little bit of an internal Googling crash course on how to do videos. And we started with a slightly different concept that didn't work, which was more advertorial. Here's the product. Here are some facts with a nice voiceover of someone saying it's 41 millimeters. And those serve a great purpose, but they're what YouTube terms as hygiene content. I don't know, this may be too boring and technical.
No, this is exactly what we want here.
But YouTube breaks things down into hero, hub, and hygiene content. Hero is your big budget adverts, the ones that go out on telly that you spend all the money on and are whiz bang shiny. Hygiene are the things that people search for. So how big is a Rolex Submariner? Mm. And there's a video showing you. You go looking for that. What we were interested in was the hub content. The stuff that people don't search for, it's the stuff that you put out for people and they are waiting for it.
Yeah.
Got you.
And here's the big difference that we were allowed to do. We were given the freedom to do with a very small team, bear in mind, we were allowed to go and produce the kind of content that we would want to see. And that worked. We put our first video up and we did this. We had just moved offices to a slightly larger office and the upstairs was vacant and we needed a light controlled studio set up to do this. And we went and bought a load of damp proof course, which for anyone who's not familiar with that is the black lining that you'll see poking out your house, two brick courses above ground level that stops the water soaking up into your house. It's big bin liners, basically.
It's like the black version of an IKEA blue bag.
Yep.
Exactly, yep. And we hung those from the ceiling to create a controlled light space. And we bought some very flimsy tripods and hung a camera. I think we had a Blackmagic cinema camera at the time. And we invested our whole budget into this thing, precariously pointed it down at some hands. We couldn't get faces in. It was too much work. So we just pointed it at some hands. Partly by chance, partly premeditated, because the idea isn't for us to make a celebrity of me. You know, what I'm talking about, I'm reflecting my experiences with the brand that I've built up over 10 years, that I want to let people know that this is the kind of experience that you'll have when you talk to anyone. And that's a really, really hard thing for us to do, but we're working very, very hard trying to pick people who have that passion and knowledge to service all of the people who do purchase watches. But it's not about me. I'm not a particularly shy individual, but nor do I want to take the credit for all of the work that has gone on. This channel wouldn't exist without Watchfinder by any means. They gave me the opportunity to do this. And, you know, I really, really enjoy seeing the comments that people leave. But ultimately, that's what we did. We set up this shot. I had some notes. I stumbled through them whilst filming the hands holding the watch. Don't ever go back to the earliest videos. They're awful.
I say that about our podcast. Don't worry.
Oh, it's, but they built the foundation for what we have now, and things have been refined over time. You know, I'm a little bit better at presenting now, I think, a little bit better at writing. We have two videographers now. We started with one who shoot the watches. They take in turns to shoot and edit. They're better. And our little group of three, we now think we have a format that, I mean, flattery is the greatest form of whatever the rest of the expression is that I've forgotten. It's really, really, really rewarding for me to not only see the feedback that we've had doing these videos, but also to see the community and creators kind of jumping on board with it. And funnily enough, I often find that members of the community just getting started will come and ask for advice. And Chloe and Tom, the videographers, will say, don't tell them anything, because they've got these hard-earned skills that they've learned over time that we've built up together. But for me, what we do as Watchfinder, what we do as Watchfinder is something that we have built up as part of who we are, our personality. People know that's us. But two, we want to be part of the community. We want to share that knowledge. And so we will happily offer advice to people, tell them what equipment we use, tell them where we find our information or whatever.
Okay. What equipment do you use then just now?
I'm not telling you.
Such a tease.
So we use a Blackmagic Ursa Mini 4.6K, the original version, as our primary camera. I say primary camera. We don't have a secondary camera. We have an Arri T2 Fresnel for our key light, mm-hmm. and an Arri T1. No, I've got that the wrong way around. T1 for the key light, T2 for the fill light. We only have fill on one side because our studio setup means we can't fit another light on the other side. Those are shot through one-stop diffusion.
How far away from the watch are the lights situated?
The lights are as far back as we can get them in the space, which is a couple of meters, meter and a half.
See, this is something people get wrong. They think because a watch is a small item, you can get the light within a meter, within a foot, because it's a wee small watch. But the fall off because of the inverse square law means the further away you can put something that's large, the better quality of light you end up with. And that's why a lot of YouTubers don't have great content, because they don't understand lighting. You guys do. Yeah. You're the masters at it.
And it's something that the department, in working for a company that has, despite what people think, pretty small margins on products, we don't have enormous budgets. And that means that we have to think very creatively, and we have to go and do our research. But myself and the team, we are very, very not just passionate about watches, but we also love creation. We're the kinds of nerds who watch the full backlog of behind the scenes on Lord of the Rings and pause to see, hang on a minute, what kind of diffusion have they got there? Oh, is that a half grid? What's going on? We like to disseminate all of that sort of stuff and see what we can learn from it. Yep. And the lighting, people always ask, what's the camera? What's the lenses? 100mm macro L from Canon and the 65mp. The lighting is so important. It's so, so important.
Yeah.
Because you can point your camera with your fancy, fancy Arri camera with your fancy, fancy lenses at a watch, and it look utter rubbish if you don't control the lighting. So too soft, everything gets washed out. Too hard, everything, you get really crisp shadows and you don't get to illuminate the reflective surfaces, and you need somewhere in between. You need a little hotspot with a little bit of roll off just to cover off both. And it gives actually a very, very simple setup that means you don't have to do a lot of changes. A couple of little bits of white card for reflection, maybe, just to fill in the area where we don't have a fill light. But it's really straightforward. And a lot of that inspiration comes from sort of a personal cinematographer hero of mine, Roger Deakins.
Oh, yeah. I know that name.
Roger Deakins, cinematographer, Skyfall, I think.
Yeah.
Sicario, recently did Blade Runner 2049, finally got his Oscar. Shawshank Redemption. The amazing thing about him is he does very, very simple lighting that's very, very effective. He also has a forum, and you can go and talk to him on the forum and ask him for advice. Again, that it's not the tools that make the art, it's the understanding, the knowledge, and the creativity. And we produce the TV adverts in-house as well with all of the skills that we've learned. And the very first one that we did, and I don't know if you'll have seen it, but if I say it's the one with the spider, that might trigger a few people's memories who are listening. The whole principle of it was we needed to tell people about part exchange and selling. So we had this kind of idea. It was a hyper-real idea that people have forgotten their watch. They have been put down in the back of the bathroom cupboard, or a kid has taken it and it's found its way under the couch, or it's been put down in the shed before doing the lawn. And the advert follows the series of detritus that builds up in front of it until eventually the watch is found again, and you know, you are inspired to sell the watch to Watchfinder. Obviously, no one is forgetting their watches in that sort of sense, but it's kind of a hyper-real fun way of representing it.
Yeah.
But we wanted to show this advert, which is on YouTube. If I don't know if you want to link it or if that's something that's too much.
I think it's called It's Time to Move On. Is that the one?
Exactly, yeah. And we shot that using principles that we'd learned from people like Roger Deakins, who were very kind of willing to share. Shot it in a meeting room on a table over the course of a few days, with, I think we had about £4,000 of budget. £2,000 was spent on the voiceover. One of the reasons why I do voiceovers now is because it's cheaper. We put together an advert that when I showed on the forum to Roger Deakins, he was like, yeah, that's really good. Well done.
Holy shit.
What a moment that was. What a moment that was. Just tying that all together.
Nice.
And it's the same method of learning and the principles that we've used to create those things that we put into the YouTube channel. And fundamentally, it's about understanding. And if you ever get to talk to any of my team, they'll roll their eyes if you say this to them. It's all about understanding what the audience wants to hear, not what we want to tell them. I could sit here all day and say, hey, pre-owned watches, you could buy them for cheaper. And people will get to that themselves. If they want to do that, great. But what we want to talk about, and what we can talk about with passion and enthusiasm, is our love for watches. We can tell those stories.
Well, let's equate that back to other forms of advertising. The way Breitling used to market and advertise their watches was to show a pilot doing cool stuff. They didn't say, buy this watch and it will keep you on time for your meetings.
Yeah, exactly.
The reason that name was familiar with me is I'd recently seen a video. I just went and checked there what it was, and it was Quentin Tarantino versus Roger Deakins talking about using film or digital. And that was on the Alter Cine channel on YouTube. So that's where his name had popped up from. Mm-hmm. But that's fantastic that there are these facilities available. You can go on and directly interface with somebody of that standing, ask questions and actually show them your showreel and get some positive feedback on it.
Yeah.
But I've got a couple of questions before we go further on, because you're plying us with so much information that I do have some questions. A couple of things. One, when you guys are doing the video, how do you do the loom shots? Because when I've tried it and other people have tried it, if you're using like a UV torch, it always puts a purple tinge on the watch. How do you guys get the loom to come up the proper colour?
So we use a free editing and colour grading software, which actually comes, you can either download it for free by itself, or you can purchase a Blackmagic camera and it comes bundled in with the camera, the full version.
DaVinci Resolve.
Absolutely fantastic piece of software that's evolved a huge amount over the last few years to include more in the editing side and to generally beef up some of the flakiness that it had before. And I think the only thing you lose out on if you get the free version is noise reduction.
Right.
I think there may be some stereoscopic stuff and 4K perhaps, but if you're looking to get into editing and you want a free piece of software, DaVinci Resolve is industry standard and is absolutely fantastic.
Well, they use that in Hollywood for proper movies.
Yeah, absolutely.
As you say, it used to be, oh God, it was Premiere and then it was like After Effects and Final Cut, but DaVinci, they get bought over by Blackmagic a number of years ago and their software was, it used to just be for colour grading.
Exactly.
From what I know. And then it's just now it encompasses other people use it now for audio editing as well. It's fantastic.
Yeah, I think it's got the Fairlight module now for the audio editing. And we still use Audition for that just because Fairlight seems a little bit flaky and it works for us for the time being. But I'm sure at some point it will be good enough to jump ship for. But the color grading module is utterly fantastic and it works in a node-based system, which if you're used to something like Photoshop, which is a layer-based system, or After Effects and Premiere, they're layer-based systems. Node-based systems take a little bit of getting used to, but they make so much sense when you do. They're layers just in little bubbles that you can link together however which way you like. And so within the color grading software, you can use a thing called a qualifier, which allows you to set parameters for hue, saturation, and loom, and it will create a moving mask for you. Mm-hmm. So with the UV lights, you say, well, it's lighting the loom in blue or green or whatever. I don't want the purple. Select the purple, desaturate. Now, brilliant. I'm sorry, Tom, if you're listening to this and you hear your trade secrets being busted, but...
How do you get rid of the dust on the dials? That's the next question.
How do we get rid of it? With a blower and lots of painstaking shooting. Sometimes we can't get rid of all of them.
So do you actually open the watches up?
Oh, no. This is just on the crystal. If there's dust in the actual watch... it's there. That's the dust that you get.
Because the bane of our life is when we get sent press samples or pre-production samples.
Oh, yeah.
And we're trying to showcase the watch. Now, if you're looking at it on the TV screen, because I don't know about your stats, but our stats show that a lot more folks are using their smart TVs. So you've got an OLED panel at 65 inches with a watch that's taking up over a meter in front of you versus 40mm on the wrist. And people are looking at it and spotting scratches and scuffs, and the hands aren't exactly perfect as you'd expect from a Patek. And they leave comments saying, oh, I don't like the look of that. And we have to say, look, these are pre-production or... they're press samples that people have driven over, you know, give them a chance. But your videos, apart from some of them, most of your videos, they're almost flawless. So I thought maybe you were doing some kind of, I don't know, content aware fill or something like that. But it must just be down to, like you say, you know, proper lighting, different angles. Because even on some of my own watches, like my Rolex, I cannot spot any flaws with the crystal because it's 4.5 years old. But under macro, there's a tiny little nick that you just can't see. How long does it take to produce a video then? One of your videos, what's the process and the time involved?
Well, on the dust question, it's we don't accept pre-production models. Most of the product is our stock, and believe it or not, it's actually very hard for us to get people to send us stock, brands and things like that. But we, because of that reason, we say to them, don't send us your pre. We would rather wait until you have a production model, and we'd be a few months down the line of everyone else than to take a pre-production model.
Yeah.
And if they insist on a pre-production model, we say, go check it because it will look like what it looks like. And if it doesn't look great, then you're out of luck. And so you will see on perhaps some of the watches that we've had that, you know, you have a clear case back where the watch is a few years older. Like, yes, there'll be service, but you might see something like an oil stain on a wheel, which is just an inevitable part of a watch operating. And I think sometimes people think that movements stay immaculate, but they are engines, like in a car. They do have friction. They do have oil. And a watch that is 15 years old will not look immaculate inside. But generally speaking... If they have dust and things like that, that's usually cleared out before reassembly anyway. So the watches that we get tend to be pretty good. So you will see, I would encourage people to go back looking for one and find some dust because it's definitely there and is the bane of the existence of our videographers. So a really interesting story I heard from Piaget, and we're owned by Richemont now and people have their things to say about that. But one of the things that's really great for me on a completely selfish level is it means I get to talk to the people who make these watches now. And the brands themselves have a very polished image for good reason. You know, they want to be seen as this perfect brand. But when you talk to the people who make, so for example, the Ultimate Concept, the Altiplano Ultimate Concept, thinnest watch in the world, 2mm, the entire thing, you start to learn about the problems that they face. And those are the really interesting parts. It's no good to say, we made this watch and it's perfect and we intended it to be perfect and it was perfect first go. No one's interested in that. You know, the best films aren't about the hero doing the first thing right, the end. You want to see their struggles and how they come out the other side. That's where you really see the expertise. And they were explaining how, because this had never been done before, never in hundreds of years of watchmaking had anyone come across a problem of this magnitude, whereby they had the movement, worked fine, assembled it into the watch, was running fast, and they could not figure it out. Take the movement out, worked fine, put the movement in the watch, it was running fast. And what they discovered was that in a quest to make this watch so thin, the balance wheel was so close to the crystal, it was generating a static charge on the crystal, which was binding the mainspring. And they were like, oh, you can imagine the eureka moment after the pain of going, is this it? Is the project over? And so they put an anti-static coating on the back. That anti-static coating needs to be on everything. It really does.
Start to finish, how long does it take to put these videos together? Because we sit down for 5-10 minutes on YouTube, but behind the scenes, there must be like hours, if not days, for each one.
So we tend to, collectively, the work is around 2 days per video.
Okay.
But it's spaced out over the course of a week. So we produce, typically to keep up with our schedule, we produce two videos per week. If we've had more Watchfinder work, because of course we're doing all of our other work for the company as well, then that goes down to zero. Or if it's a little bit quiet for Watchfinder, then we can produce up to four. And between myself and one of the videographers, we will have... just to be clear, the two videographers often rotate between Watchfinder work and the YouTube videos week on week. So it'll be one videographer working on YouTube for 1 week and then another for the next week. So I tend to have a look at what watches we have available, or if we've got any watches coming in the middle of a week. I will write the scripts for the both on the Friday, usually when I can, in between the other work, if not a weekend if I run out of time. And then on Monday in the afternoon, we shoot the A and B roll, i.e. the hands stuff, the audio. And then on the Tuesday, the day is spent shooting the watch. So that's all the close-ups that you see, the insert shots of the watch. And then the Wednesday is spent editing and coloring. So that's for two videos. So about 2 days per video.
Mm. And in terms of, you said that, you know, you've got the two videographers that, you know, take those weeks around. Although they'll obviously share a lot of kind of the techniques and the way they do things. Do you think the layperson or the person watching the videos could, is there any traits that each of them have that's slightly different that when you watch the videos, you would tell which was which? Or do you think it would be pretty hard? I didn't know those two. No, there you go.
They are very competitive. So if one comes up with a new shot or a new technique, the other one immediately scrutinizes it and absorbs it into their lexicon as well. So the answer is yes, but not for any kind of trend long enough to notice, because one doesn't want the other.
One-upping them.
Yeah, it's great to see. And I really admire their tenacity. And it's made the channel what it is in terms of visual, because the evolution of how it looks and how we all do our jobs almost feels like it's never changed. But because it is evolutionary, people on YouTube don't tend to like big change. So we kind of tweak things as we go.
It also must keep it quite fresh, because if the two of them are that competitive, you know, if it was one of them, given amount of time, they might become stale at it, where, as you say, if they're maybe competing with each other for these little tricks that they're picking up, it'll always keep them on their toes. So it keeps the whole channel at a level and fresh and moving forward.
Yeah, and we're all creative, so we're all quite sensitive as well. So there's there's often a lot of saying to one, no, the other's not better than you. They've just done something new. You'll get there.
It's like, which is your favourite child?
And saying to the other one who's done the good thing, the other one was really impressed with what you did. And they're like, oh, really? Really? Are you sure? But ultimately, it results in them both really, really channeling everything into their creativity.
Yeah.
And again, to iterate, and I think a lot of people think because we are part of Richemont, we have enormous budgets and teams, but we really don't. It's all fueled by passion, not just for watches, but for the process as well.
Well, one of the things I didn't realize until quite late on was that you record the audio separately from the hands-on stuff. And it was only because it was some super shiny polished bezel on a watch and I could see your lips weren't moving when there was audio and you were playing with the watch. So, you know, there's all these inside baseball things that people don't realise. And it's only become apparent to me since I started doing watch videos, because I do videography as my job, but it's weddings, it's corporate, it's music events, it's things like that. And taking even a car shoot where it is a massive thing or there's people involved and bringing it down to something that's 40 mil in diameter, it is such, it's almost like working with miniatures at ILM on a Star Wars project. It's so different. Yeah. And you guys absolutely knock it out of the park every single time. And I think what keeps me interested and everybody else, it's not just the visuals, it's not just the content of the watch, it's the way that you take people on a journey with the story. It is the ASMR of the watch industry. You know, you can listen to a 10-minute video and there maybe is only 1 minute about the watch, but there's the journey of how the watch was created, where it was used, how it's influenced the current setting. There's all these different things weaved in along the way, and it's been a journey for you, obviously, starting 10 years ago to where things are today. But with the company as a whole, taking it back to Watchfinder, how have you seen things develop since the takeover with Richemont and all the rest of it? What's the process been like behind the scenes?
Well, believe it or not, and I know a lot of people won't, but Richemont very much likes to stay in the shadows. It doesn't like to buy a company that is successful and then tell it how to not be successful anymore. The company is clearly under the radar of Richemont because of what it's achieved. And so we are left to do what we like to do and what we do best. And where Richemont really comes in is to offer advice in terms of how we turn that in from being a small company into some of those big company problems that happens when companies grow. But they've been exceptional in terms of how they help managers and staff relate to each other, building relationships across the company. Because we've all been working very hard and kind of juggling a lot of balls, and now you start to see more specialists come into the company, building those relationships from the top to the bottom can become quite difficult. Where I used to sit two seats down from the CEO, the CEO is now in a different office, in a different place, but Richemont are really helping to keep those relationships going. So the people who are making small changes, who have come in at the ground floor, can see how those changes have an impact on the overall.
Big company growing pains.
Absolutely, yeah. And one of the really important parts for me of being in Watchfinder is being able to have an influence, being not just a tiny wheel, but being able to say, hey, I've got this idea, and then saying, well, let's try it. And I think that's Richemont are really helping us not lose that. They're very, very interested in what we're doing as a brand, both from the pre-owned side of things. Online retail in watches is a very new thing, and we have some great experience in that, but also in the engagement of consumers, telling those stories. I've had some amazing conversations with people at different brands that you might initially think, oh yeah, boring. But actually, you talk to the people who are involved in making the products, the historians we have access to now, and they have just a litany of information that's never been shared before, that's just waiting to be told.
Yeah. No, I mean, Richemont are one of the brands that, Dave, you've obviously got a massive history with them. And when we first started Scottish Watches, it was one of the Richemont events we got invited to, which was with Montblanc, and they were fantastic.
I think what you said there, Andrew, is interesting. So, you know, they've come in and they've assisted with the kind of top line and high level issues that, you know, the business probably needed the help with to get to where they are or whilst they grow, without micromanaging and trying to change a successful kind of recipe of what works, which is great to hear, because, you know, I think a lot of people think that these big businesses come in and almost road roller over, you know, everything that was done. But it also sounds like, you know, giving you access to these brands and allowing some of these stories to be told, it's quite good, because you've got that degree of separation. You know, sometimes these companies, due to their corporate structures, maybe it's not that they don't let the stories be told, but they don't think it's interesting, or they don't think it fits their marketing narrative for the brand. But with you having that access, you now can kind of start to get those stories out in a way that is authentic as well, which I think is a great access.
It's good to hear that they've been hands off. And being honest, looking back since I got into watches 4 and a bit years ago, I've not seen any changes that would be from a corporate overlord or an influence from higher ups with what you guys are doing. And you are the yardstick that everybody in the UK compares watch prices to. You know, it's like, how much is it on Watchfinder? Is it available in Watchfinder? What year is it? Blah, blah, blah. And I use it myself, not daily, but on a weekly basis to check different things. You know, how much is my collection worth? How much is this watch? How much is that watch? And it is a really good resource that hasn't been tainted by the takeover, which is absolutely fantastic, because it could so easily, could it? Look how many businesses out there do get absolutely shat on when they're taken over because somebody higher up goes, oh, well, actually, I think this could change to that. But the whole point of taking the business on is because it works and you want to improve it, not to shit on it.
Well, think how easy it could be to take the YouTube channel and slap adverts all over it and make it more of a sales push. But Richemont recognizes, and the brand recognizes, that there is more to becoming part of the community and offering something of value than there is to try and take the quick win. And I don't know, some might see that with a cynical eye as an invasion of their personal space in the watch community. But genuinely, what we want to offer is an experience for people that is authentic, that is completely enjoyable. You can come back to, you can read an article, you can watch a video, you can engage with it and go away. You do not have to buy anything, and nor do you want to be pushed to anything.
Yeah, I think that's quite an interesting kind of take as well. You know, that there is that aspect of it that is a bit of a knowledge base. And whilst you say, I'm sure there are people who look at it a little bit suspiciously, as in, okay, what's the agenda? They're obviously trying to sell me something. Where's the catch? But, you know, it does feel, and I think more from speaking with you today, that you know, whilst obviously there is the business aspect, of course they want to sell things, there is the aspect of the business, that's what it's about. But it feels like, you know, you guys, you know, have this kind of luxurious space almost in modern terms, where a lot of businesses just don't allow it to happen, that you've got this creative space to create stuff for no other real reason than for the kind of enjoyment of people, you know, watching the content and taking up that content. And whilst, yes, I'm sure it's got the greater uplift and positivity to the brand and the business, you know, the content's coming from a genuine place. It's not coming from a, let's just make this show, we can sell more of that. It's coming from a place that, because you want to, you know, for no other reason than let's create content that's good and it's interesting and it's kind of absorbing.
Well, they didn't buy Watchfinder just because of the YouTube channel. I know, Andrew, I'm sorry, we just have to break that to you slowly and gently there. But they bought it, obviously they took it over because it was making profit. And if a business is profitable and you can take it over, then you can make profit, then that's the way it works. It's not to control or change things. You know, it just offers an umbrella of corporate information, like you say, you know, HR things. If there's new people coming on board, then they're a massive company. It was Richemont that took me across with Adrian to the GLC factory, and they know what they're doing. They've been doing it for X amount of decades, if not hundreds of years, encompassing all the different brands that they deal with. If they hadn't taken it over, I don't know how different things would be just now, but there's definitely not been any negatives that I've spotted. And from going from the 20 employees 10 years ago, where does that sort of employee count sit just now?
I think we're around 200.
Right.
And that's in the growth of Watchfinder in terms of a physical sense. We have stores not just in the UK, but opening around the world now. And of course, it's important to have people in those places so the customers have someone who's on their time zone to talk to. But also in the growth of those, there's more management in terms of logistics and servicing and everything that goes with it. So the company has to grow with that. So our service center, which was a few people, is now a whole floor in a building, and is going to grow even further. It's obviously very important for us to be able to stand by the quality of the product that's sold. And you can imagine, if we didn't have the investment in the service center and the product wasn't of a good quality, that it would only come to bite us on the ass anyway. So let's just have a really good service center that's manufacturer certified, etc., and just save that whole deal. Let's just do it right. And it's actually really fascinating, the principles of getting certified by a manufacturer. Each one is different. Each one has their own requirements. You cannot duplicate between one and the other. It is excruciatingly tedious. The watchmakers that I've spoken to who have been through the process, who have had to procure the equipment, that have had to go on the train, that have had to, and they say, it's silly, we have this piece of equipment that does this, and that's basically the same as, no, you have to have the other piece of equipment for the other brand. AP, for example, the finishing on those Royal Oaks, the angular shapes that they have, oh my word, it's not a case of a polishing wheel and a brushing wheel. It's this lapping and masking and all of these individual steps. And AP make sure you can do it, and they make sure that you can still do it exactly how they want it. So that's an enormous part of the growth, for sure. But something that we're really, really keen to do more of as we grow further is to take what we have with the YouTube channel, which is a corner of Watchfinder that is a community-driven, enthusiast-led pool of entertainment, and make that more of an experience that's integral to Watchfinder. Not in any kind of sense that's pushing sales more. If anything, it's the other way around. We want people to feel that they can rely on Watchfinder to get whatever kind of watch news they want to get, but we don't want to be in competition with people. We want to be part of the community. If we do this podcast with you, we want to tell people about it. We all want to work together. I've always found it very strange. Being a plug author, I find there's a lot of competition between authors in a space, in a genre. People read more than one book.
Yeah,
people absolutely can watch more than one YouTube video. Let's all work together. Let's all be part of a community. And that's, you know, one of the reasons why I'm really excited to chat with you today, because I, from a personal perspective, it's great to be a part of this community.
Have you done any podcasts or interviews or other stuff on other people's channels yet, or are we the first?
The very first thing we did was last week with...
God damn it.
But with Langer for Watches and Wonders.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay.
So this is the first editorial platform that we've done this with. And the reason that we haven't done it before is simply because we're rushed off our feet doing what we're already doing.
Yeah.
We want to avoid the ego of being like, oh, hey, we'll feature on your podcast because we're so great. But being invited is awesome. Having the time to do it is awesome. And having an achievement that we've got to talk about is awesome.
Well, before we finish up, yeah, we will have you back because that's an hour gone. Instantly, you sent me a couple of bullet points that we could have chatted about, and I apologise because we didn't get near any of them. None at all.
I've been blabbing.
Oh no, not at all. I think I had loads of questions, but it was just great hearing you talk and just kind of, you know, eloquently kind of put points across. And I think we could probably fill another two episodes easily with different things to talk about.
If the head honchos at Watchfinder Richemont are up for it, I think we should be doing another episode. Before we do finally finish this one, I want to ask you a couple of questions. Of all the watches that you've had your hands on, because I'm pretty sure you have a say in what appears in front of the lens, what would you say is either your standout watch of all the videos that you've done or your top three in no particular order, and why?
My standout watch is a very easy one, and not just because of the watch but because of the experience. We had not been in Richemont long, and you know, being with the brands being left to their own devices, it's not just a case of Richemont saying, work with Watchfinder. We have to earn their trust. We have to demonstrate that the value of what we have is valid, is good. And one of the first brands to do that with us is one of my favorites, Erlanger Zona. Apologies for the pronunciation. And it started off as, you know, hi, Andrew, we'd love to do something with you. What are you interested in? And I said, lol, a triple split, please. And they said, sure. And they posted us a triple split. And that experience demonstrated for me the confidence they have in their product, which for me is just absolute pinnacle level, but also their enthusiasm for the little guy. Because a Watchfinder is big in the UK, but in the world, it's a little guy. Certainly was back then, certainly in relation to big brands like Cartier and other Maisons that are part of the Richemont group. But they were willing to engage with us, and they sent us stuff and they spoke with us and they let us do silly jokes. I mean, what I say let, we either do them or we don't. But of course, you understand that we don't want to burn our bridges.
It's a tightrope. We walk it every day.
Yeah, they don't say you cannot say this, but they might say, oh, we'd rather you didn't say it's a bit like a pineapple or something like that, you know. And but what it really also demonstrated to me was I've handled Langers before, but the more complicated ones are harder to get hold of. They're limited in number. Langer produces barely any watches. I think 2,000 watches a year compared to Patek, which is something like 70,000. As an aside, actually, before I talk about the triple split, and if you have time, after we had posted a few videos, I had a very excitable email from my contact at Langer. He said, are you available? Mr. Schmidt wants to talk to you. And, you know, and I'm sure there are many other people in this field who have spoken to him many a time, and that's no big deal. But for me, it was one of kind of excitement to talk to the man who's in charge of this thing, but also trepidation. What's he going to be like? Is this going to be corporate? We spent an hour talking about how cheap AP perpetual calendars can be on auction if they're not Royal Oaks. And he was going, have you seen how much you can get a Roger Dubuis? Is it the Heritage Chronograph, the one that's really popular now? Have you seen how cheap you can get those for now? Like, he was just talking about these watches that he's, like all the rest of us, we have on our peripherals that we're thinking about all the time about purchasing. This guy was a watch enthusiast through and through. And he's like, when you come here, I'll have to show you. We've got this archive of enamel dials. We don't know what to do with them, but they're awesome. I want to come and show you. And was just an utterly, utterly passionate man about all of it.
We need to speak to him.
Yeah, we do. It's funny you say that as well. That's very similar to, I spent a bit of time with Davide, who obviously just recently left Mont Blanc Minerva. And at the same, when you get him going on a topic, it doesn't need to be about his brand or the brand he works for. He's just passionate about, you know, watches in general, or cars, or fishing, or whatever else he decides he can find commonality with. We forget these are just people like us. You know, they have their loves, they have their passions in life as well. And it's great when you see that side of them and not just the let's talk about the new this and the new that.
But it's unique.
Exactly.
I've said this before. The guy that runs Ford, the guy that runs General Motors, he's probably not a petrol head. He's probably a businessman that wants to make money.
Yeah.
But when we had Jean-Claude Biver on the show, we couldn't shut the guy up. It was one of the hardest edits ever to try and get it down to 1 hour, because the passion just emits from every pore in his body. Mm-hmm. And that's what you want. He was talking about the Apple Watch, saying it was this almost the saviour of the entry into watches for people, and it's true. So that's good. No, we have to speak to the main dude at ELS. So you can forward us an email address, Andrew, and we'll give him a shout. But no, that's fantastic. Yeah. Listen, we're already over. I'm going to have to spend a bit of time trying to chop out silences to get this to under the hour mark. But this has been a long time coming, and it's been well worth the wait. So, Andrew, thank you very much for coming on the show. Thanks to the guys at Watchfinder for making this possible. If you want to tell anybody who doesn't know how to find you or Watchfinder or the videos where you guys are.
Well, I don't know if you've heard, but there's a pre-owned watch retailer called Watchfinder, and you can access that in the uk.co.uk or anywhere else in the world with your URL. Check us out on YouTube as well. You just punch in Watchfinder, I'm sure you'll find us. And again, to you guys, thank you so much for having us. We've been fans of yours, and we've used you as a benchmark for our humour and our conversation for a very long time. You absolutely stand out compared to some of the stuffy stuff that is out there. So congratulations on what you do.
Brilliant. Well, that is a show. That was epic fun. We went down a lot of rabbit holes. We went down the video side of things. We went down the history. We found out more about the man with the hands. But if you want to check out the rest of our stuff, at Scottish Watches on Instagram. We've also got a YouTube channel, but it's a little bit lacking because we don't have the time, and we don't have two videographers to work on it, unfortunately, and we do podcasts every week. You can check that out as well, and the website scottishwatches.co.uk. So thanks for listening, and we will catch you guys again soon.
Take care.
Bye bye.